Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. That's Ann, A-N-N, Liguori, L-I-G-U-O-R-I.com. And distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Well, with the influx of money in pro golf, particularly with the rise of lucrative sponsorships, prize money, and the rival tour LIV Golf, the professional game has been transformed. The massive contracts offered to various players by LIV Golf, backed by Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, have certainly raised questions about players prioritizing money over tradition, competition, and values. Skyrocketing prize money, increased purses on the PGA Tour, the FedEx Cup purses, the rewarding PGA Tour players for loyalty, and most recently, the news that U.S. players on the Ryder Cup team will be paid have sparked many an adverse reaction from golf fans. All these developments in professional golf, I would think, tend to make fans appreciate top amateur golfers even more, in addition to the history of golf and the top amateurs who made that history. These golfers played the game for the sheer joy and competition. The notion of amateur golfers embodies virtues that make the game of golf unique and enriching. Their approach to the sport often reflects a purer, more genuine connection to the game, untainted by financial incentives or external pressures. Amateur golfers remind us that the essence of the game lies not in the prize money, but in the joy of the game, the connections it creates, and the personal growth it fosters. One of the greatest amateur golfers ever was Bill Hindman. Hindman lived from 1915 to 2001. And won 2 U.S. Senior Amateur Championships, 3 Philadelphia Amateur titles, represented the U.S. in 5 Walker Cups, and played in 9 Masters. Talk about an incredible amateur career. His triumphs and heartbreaks are beautifully detailed in John Riley's book called A Will to Win, legendary amateur Bill Hindman's story of perseverance and triumph. John Riley joins me this hour to talk about Bill Hindman's life, his stellar amateur career, how he maintained and thrived during his long career while coping with things like the loss of his father at the young age of 14, the death of his 3-year-old daughter, and the loss of his brother in World War II. John Riley also wrote about the great Ed Porky Oliver in his book titled How He Played the Game, Ed Porky Oliver and Golf's Greatest Generation. Now, Porky Oliver was born in 1915 in Wilmington, Delaware, and his initial foray into the world of golf was as a caddy at the Wilmington Country Club. He turned pro at the age of 19, playing on the tour in the 40s and 50s, winning 8 times. He finished second in the 3 U.S. Major Golf Championships. But perhaps his greatest accomplishments, as described by John Riley, was his role in attracting fans and helping to popularize the golf tour, way before Arnold Palmer took over that distinction. As author Tom Coyne pointed out in his praise of the book, in quotes, Riley's research affords us the chance to walk around in that golden era of Hogan and Nelson and Snead. Thanks to these pages, golf's greatest generation is made greater by adding Ed Porky Oliver's name to that rare roll call, end quote. So who is John Riley who brings these golf greats to the forefront? Well, John retired as a corporate PR executive in 2016 and began a new career as an author at the age of 70. He's from the Wilmington, Delaware area, connecting him to both Bill Hindman and Porky Oliver, both of whom are from that area. In 2017, John joined former Philadelphia Eagle Kevin Riley as co-author of his book, Tackling Life. In October 2019, John published an award-winning memoir, Delaware Eyewitness, Behind the Scenes in the First State It covers his work with various leaders and provides an inside look at the circumstances and leadership failures of a great chemical company. John is currently working on a book about Jay Siegel, two-time U.S. amateur champion who earned 10 victories on the PGA Senior Tour. Now, John has played golf since he was 11 years old. His father exposed him to the game, and John was a caddy as well. John told me that it was his brother's passion for the game that got him going. He was always trying to compete with his brother at whatever he was doing. Since he was a year and a half older than John, John says he was always playing catch-up. John's favorite win was the mixed team championship at Wilmington Country Club with his daughter, Carrie. Ironically, John tells me, they beat his high school golf coach and a woman who once scored 2 holes-in-1s in 9 holes. John won the Fort Knox Open in the Army back in 1971. He was runner-up for the Junior State Championship in 1963, and he qualified for the National JC Championship in 1962, which was won by Jay Siegel in 1961. And John had a 41-10 collegiate match play record, which at the time was the best in the history of the University of Delaware, where John captained the golf team. So yes, golf has been a part of John Riley's life for a long time. John is a past recipient of the annual award of the Delaware State Golf Association for contributions to the game of golf, including supporting the First Tee and the BMW Championship, which funds the Evans Scholars Foundation. John is an Army veteran, and he continues to be active in veteran affairs. He recently chaired the development committee for the commissioning of the nuclear attack submarine USS Delaware and serves on the commissioning committee for the aircraft carrier John F. Kennedy. John and his wife Sharon, married 54 years, live in Wilmington. They have 3 children and 7 grandchildren. This morning, we will dive deep into the histories of both Bill Hindman and Ed Porky Oliver as told by John Riley. John Riley's career as an author began at the age of 70. The former PR executive is working on his 5th book. And in this sports interview segment, we will get to know John, what motivated him to begin a most successful second career so late in life, about the top golfers he writes about, who all have a connection in some way to John, to his hometown of Philadelphia, and who reached the top echelons in the game. Through his last 2 books, How He Played the Game, Ed Porky Oliver and Golf's Greatest Generation, in addition to his latest book, A Will to Win, legendary amateur Bill Hindman's story of perseverance and triumph, and a new book John is working on with Jay Siegel, one of the most celebrated amateurs in the history of American golf, John Riley has covered a century of golf through the stories of these golfers, all from the Philadelphia area, who all flew under the radar, who all overcame challenging circumstances, and who were and should be honored for their impact on the game. John Riley, welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.
Ann, good to be with you.
So your most recent book, A Will to Win, about the legendary amateur Bill Hindman's story of perseverance and triumph. Tell us a little bit about Bill Hindman and why he was one of the greatest players in the history of amateur golf.
Bill... As I say, kind of flew below the radar, and he's not greatly remembered today, but should be. He was certainly well decorated during his time. I think one of the reasons he's maybe not as remembered as he should be is because he never, as he put it, won the big one. He was a 4-time finalist for the national championships without winning. However, his consistency over 20 years was incredible. And to go back to how he overcame adversity, how he became successful, he really had an early life filled with a lot of tragedy. And began when his father died at the age of 14, just as the Great Depression was beginning. So it was he and his mother and his little brother, who he ended up raising. And he got married in 1938. He and his wife, Jenny, had a baby girl. She came down with bone cancer as a 3-year-old and died 7 months later. There was really no treatment at the time. Chemotherapy had not even been developed until 1949. So there was really nothing they could do. And then soon after, his brother walked out the door to become a pilot in World War II, and he was killed within the year. So it seemed like it was one thing after another. He was a great amateur golfer, great all-around athlete, but just always, didn't have the career. He was working in a, in a factory, and eventually he changed a few things in his life and took off.
We'll get back to Bill Hindman in a second, but the book you released before that one is about Ed Porky Oliver. And Oliver rose from the caddy ranks to become one of the leading professional golfers in the world. And he faced golf legends like Walter Hagen and Gene Sarazen. And he beat Sam Snead and Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson and Jimmy DeMeritt. And best-selling golf author Tom Coyne is quoted on the cover of Will to Win, saying in quotes, "Golfers should be grateful for John Riley, who finds untold golf stories and tells them with page-turning detail," end quote. And boy, the details in these books, John, is just incredible. The research, I want to ask you about that in a second, but I know you had a personal connection to these players. Talk about your personal connection to both Hindman and Oliver.
Well, as my father actually was a caddy with Oliver growing up, and his nickname as a boy was Snowball. Snead actually gave him the nickname of Porky for some obvious reasons a little later on in his career. But all the kids in Delaware knew him as Snowball. And of course, that resulted from his all-around talent, which, among other things, included being incredibly accurate throwing snowballs. So so my father had the connection as a boy. In fact, my father won the caddy championship at Wilmington Country Club the year before Oliver, who was a year younger than him. And then the Olivers moved back to Delaware, and I ended up going to school with his son Bobby, and Bobby became one of my closest friends. He played on the high school golf team with me. So that was the Oliver connection. I only saw Mr. Oliver a couple of times as a boy. In fact, one tragically, he was suffering from lung cancer and had recently had his lung removed. And I remember being myself almost traumatized looking at him laying on the couch in their little house down the street from ours.
Wow, and he almost won the 61 Crosby and made the cut at the Masters in 64. And at the time, Oliver was suffering from lung cancer, which is unbelievable that he could play.
Yeah, it was actually the 60 Crosby, which I believe Venturi ended up winning, but he was within a shot going into the last 9 holes of the tournament. It was probably, and the Crosby's always been famous, today's AT&T, for the weather, and on that particular event was probably the worst weather ever. But he played all the way, never realizing he had a hacking cough. He was a smoker, but as he finds out later, he's got lung cancer. And then a little later on, of course, it's April, he makes the cut at the Masters, and he gets really, really sick a week later trying to play in the Colonial, drives home. At that time, he was a pro in Denver, driving home to Denver. And by the time he got there, they put him in the hospital and removed his lung. He was that far gone with lung cancer.
Wow. And you were able to see him at the very end.
Yes, it was as I say, it was it for me as a boy, seeing someone in that physical state was a little shocking. And he didn't live much longer. It was he was beloved by everybody on the golf tour. Absolutely, I would rank him and I do some of this in the book. He really did a tremendous amount to develop the early tour. He was extremely popular. Certainly, you look at the American triumvirate of Snead, Hogan, and Nelson to really, create the tour to a great extent as we know it. But right after that, you would probably say demerit because of also his play and also his entertaining. abilities, but certainly in that group was Porky Oliver. I mean, people flocked to see him play. He was an entertaining guy who usually did the exhibitions. He had a repertoire of trick shots and was just a great character, but he was also very, very competitive. Frankly, if it wasn't for Ben Hogan, he probably would have had three major championships.
Right. And didn't he get drafted as well? That took him away for a number of years.
Yeah, he as the saying goes, if Porky didn't have bad luck, he wouldn't have any at all. And that seemed to be his nature. He got disqualified in the 1940 U.S. Open, highly controversial decision that really should have never happened. But it had to do with the fact that they played 36 the last day, and they said he and a couple other players, including Claude Harmon, by the way, were all disqualified, they said, because they teed off too early. And Oliver was told to go finish his round. He ends up tied for first with Sarrazin and Lawson Little, and then he's kicked out of the playoff.
Wow.
So that was his first experience. Then he's at the Oakland Open in 1940. This is a year before Pearl Harbor, and he gets handed a draft notice, has to get in the car, drives across the country. He was defending champion at the time in the Crosby, and he gets a reprieve from the draft board when he gets home, drives all the way back to the Crosby, and plays with Bing Crosby in the first round, shoots a 67 after driving across the country. He later, a couple weeks later, he meets he plays in the Western Open, which at the time was considered a major championship. You know, one of the raps on Oliver is that he didn't win a major, but in 1941, the Western Open was considered by many, including Nelson and Hagen and everybody, as a major championship. But he came to the last round behind Hogan and Nelson, and blew past both of them in 36 holes the last day and won the Western Open. Also, Snead was another couple shots behind. And just 2 weeks after that, he's yanked into the Army, and he's gone for over 4.5 years. And although he didn't go to combat, he really had very little opportunity to play. Some of the other players, like Snead and Hogan, they got a chance to play. Most of them didn't go into the service for at least another 2 years. So that was another piece of hard luck for poor Porky.
And yet he came back and, as you mentioned, accomplished so much, was named to three Ryder Cup teams, and other accolades. So, boy, this guy was able to overcome all these challenges, and so was Hyneman, really. You write about these great players who why were they under the radar, do you think, John? Why weren't they just more well known?
I do think it had a lot to do with the fact that they, in the modern game, so not taking nothing away from Gene Sarazen, who, by the way, thought the world of Oliver. He convinced them to go on a barnstorming trip around the country where they played exhibitions all over the country, sponsored by, at that time, Golf Magazine, because Sarazen just thought it, there was nothing in the world like him. And, it was just that they, perhaps with both he and Hyman, they did not win that major tournament. And when you look back at the records, those are the ones that you see listed. They won a lot. They beat the top players of the day, but they just didn't really get the recognition in the end. And they really weren't picked up. Even Oliver, when he was picked up by the historians, the golf historians, it really tended to be in a negative way, which was really sad. As I say, he was beloved by everybody. He was named honorary captain of the 1961 Ryder Cup team. They were trying to convince him to go to England to play that year. He's dying of cancer. I just think that, and the same with Hyneman, who died. Hyneman actually died like 48 hours before 9/11. And as a result of that, if you remember the papers at the time, it just took over our lives, right, for
Sure.
months.
Right.
And I think it was barely noticed that he was gone. Again, he didn't win the big one, but he did something no one else has come close to, and that is that he actually appeared in the top 10 of the Golf Digest ratings of the best amateurs in the country 20 times. The only one who's even close is Jay Sigel. Now, half of those were as a senior, and he did eventually get his redemption, and he won two U.S. Senior Amateur Championships. And of course, that's the redemption that Oliver was never able to experience because of him, prematurely at such an early age coming down with lung cancer.
Well, Bill Hindman enjoyed many highlights in his career. One was hitting a great shot on the road hole at St. Andrews with none other than Bobby Jones looking on. What was that like?
It's funny because Hyman, no matter when he played, he was typically always the oldest. And he was the oldest on the world amateur cup team that year, being captained by Bobby Jones, 1958 at St. Andrews. And the United States just was having a lot of trouble. The team was Bud Taylor, Charlie Coe, Billy Joe Patton. It was a great team, a colorful team, and Hyman. And it came down the last day to the U.S. team being two behind going into the road hole with Hyman, the last guy on the course. And Bobby Jones came out in a cart, first time a golf cart was ever allowed onto St. Andrews in this terrible weather. And he tells Hyman that somehow or other he has to birdie the last two holes and he's on the 17th hole, which, if you
No
escape the
pressure there.
17th with a bogey, you're happy. So. He proceeds to and Jones had given them strict instructions not to go for the 17th green because the risk was too great, and Hyman looked over at him and said, "Bobby, I'm going for it," and hit the 4 iron of his life to about 6 feet, knocked it in. For in those days it was an eagle. In those days the road hole was a par five.
That's right.
So all he had to do was to par the last hole, which he did to gain a tie for the United States, with Billy Joe Patton yelling at him all the way up the fairway. I mean, Billy Joe Patton was one of the great characters in the history of amateur golf. A lot of people don't realize that back in those days, the amateurs and the pros were extremely competitive with one another. Charlie Coe and Patton, who were on that team, both finished second in the Masters. And again, I don't think many people realize that today about how good the amateurs were and how they matched up all the time against the pros.
Well, I hope Bobby Jones gave him a good pat on the back after that shot.
Yeah, he became pretty close to Bobby Jones. Funny story. So Bobby Jones invites him to become a member at Augusta National. Well, he was still trying to build a business and, he support his family and all of that. And so he tells Jones, "I really can't afford it now to join the club, but thank you very much." So about a year or two later, and he played in nine Masters, he was invited to 11. A year or two later, he comes back again and asks him if he wants to join. And he still doesn't feel like he can afford it. And anyway, so a few years later, he's really established himself in business. He's a very successful guy. He's renowned across the country. And he goes up to Clifford Roberts and he asks Clifford Roberts if he can join now. And he says, sorry, Bill, but nobody turns us down two times and
What
gets
a
away with it. You are
story.
not going to be a member." It's
Oh my
funny
God.
because I talked to the historian at Augusta and he goes, "Well, that sounds like Mr. Roberts."
From what I read, it certainly does sound like Clifford Roberts for sure. And I know Bill Hindman had a win over Jack Nicklaus in the 59 British Amateurs, so he beat some mega stars for sure.
Yeah, and again, that was something that started a lifetime friendship with Jack. I was really fortunate to be able to interview Jack. I interviewed so many great people for the book. Gary Player was terrific. Jack, of course, all the great amateurs, people like Vinnie Giles and others. But anyway, Jack, he was, he really told a funny story about it because he said they got to the fifth hole and he had hit his drive over the bunker on the right side. At that point, he was one up. And I said, they get up there, they can't find his drive. He says, 100 people looking for my golf ball. And Jack gets upset. I mean, I'm talking to him on the phone and he goes, "Now, how in the world can 100 people not find my golf ball?" He's still upset about that shot. some 55 years later. But anyway, Hyman wins the next five holes, and Jack goes, "Yay, beat me pretty good, beat me pretty good." And Jack's father later on a train going down to the later on a at another event said to Hyman that, I really appreciate that you did that. That's probably the best thing that ever happened to him. And that was the only match he lost that year. He won everything. He won the North South. He won the Trans Mississippi. He won the U.S. Amateur. He won everything. That was the only match he lost. And as Jack said, he beat me pretty good. So.
Well, John, how did you do research on these guys? Because they, most of them played at a time, before computers, before Google, before social media, before you could really instantly have access to research about either of these players, Oliver and Hyndman. So talk a little bit about the process. How did you dig deep and get so much information on both these players?
Oliver was, that was blazing new trails for me. I mean, I just knew I wanted to write a book about him. I had in my previous book, I had used newspapers.com, and I came across his name a few times, never realizing, all of his accomplishments. And I used to call myself the world expert on Porky Oliver, but even still, I didn't know a fraction of what I was to learn about him. So my process with Oliver was mostly reading old newspapers endlessly, really. I mean, just from across the country. Because he was such a colorful character, he was constantly covered by various columnists across the country. They loved him. They would tell stories about him, in the bar, talking to, different celebrities. And so anything he did became a story. So in that sense, he was kind of easy to find a lot of information on. That's another reason it's kind of funny that he became so forgotten, because he was such a big deal in his day. The other thing that was difficult with Oliver is that there was no one left with the exception of Gary Player. And Gary Player, I got a hold of Gary Player. He called me back and he says, "You wanted to talk to me about Porky Oliver?" He said he played with me in the when I won my first tournament in Kentucky in 1958. I said, "I know, Gary." So like I said, "I saw that. That's why I called you." So he was literally like a kid in the United States, and they played together in the Kentucky, or maybe it was called the Derby Open, I think, at that time. What was difficult with Oliver is, and I remember when I first talked to his kids, the youngest one was 72, Johnny.
Wow.
He was 9 when his father died. The oldest was Eddie. He was 80. And his sister, Joanne, was 79. And when I spoke to them, they all basically said the same thing. We barely knew our father. He was gone all the time. And as a result, we never really got to know him very well. Eddie did go out on the golf tour with him a little bit as a teenager. And in fact, one of Eddie's big thrills was that he used to shag balls for both Ben Hogan and for his father, because Ben Hogan and his father were pretty good friends. And they used to, I guess, hang out at the swimming pool with Valerie when they were at different events together with their mother. So that was kind of the Oliver book. The Hyman book was different. I mean, so I probably only did, a dozen interviews. One of my favorite interviews doing the Oliver book, in addition to Gary Player, was Michael Murphy from Golf in the Kingdom. That was a huge surprise. The oldest son, remembered that he was mentioned in Golf in the Kingdom. So the book had been sitting up on my shelf since I read it like 30 years ago.
Right.
And I pull it out. I don't know why I didn't remember it, but Michael Murphy had listed him in his golfing zodiac with all the greatest names in the history of golf. So I was able to track him down at some sort of a commune or something in Big Sur, California, and interview him. And we spent 45 minutes on the phone. He laughed the whole time. He's 90 years old, and he fascinating guy. But those were great interviews. There were a couple of others, but with Hyndman, a great deal. Even though I followed all of his career and the papers and everything that was written about him, The book was built more on interviews. I did 55 different interviews. A great interview, by the way, was Lanny Watkins. They played each other in the North South 3 times. Of course, Lanny's, age 19 and 20. And at age 20, he was the best amateur in the country. And Heineman is in his 50s. Then they play on the two Walker Cup teams together at St. Andrews, where they were on the team that lost. And Heineman was 55 years old. That is a record that will never be broken. I
That's
mean, by
unbelievable.
far the oldest to ever play in a Walker Cup, at least oldest American. There actually is a Brit who was like 2 months older, whose name I forget, but.
Well, speaking of age, what made you begin this second career of authoring these books at the age of 70?
Well, I had just retired, and I had always wanted to. I had told my I had done a little bit of writing. I was, among other things, I was head of public relations for a chemical company, so I did more editing than direct writing, but just enough, to be dangerous. And then I started writing columns for a local online newspaper, mostly, local color. Stories from the area. And I did that for several years. But also, I had a friend who played for the Philadelphia Eagles, went through a traumatic health crisis where he had to have his arm and shoulder amputated. And anyway, I had always told him, we need to do a book about your life. It happened to coincide. He became a very, very terrific, and his name is also Riley, but spelt different, Kevin Riley. And he became a terrific public speaker, in-demand public speaker, and people would always ask him if he had a book. I said, when I retire, we're going to write your book. So we sat down and we wrote his memoir called Tackling Life. And that just kind of gave me the bug. And of course, it kept me busy, kept me active. And it was pretty obvious that I had to move on to golf because that was such an important part of my life.
Well, talk about the book that you're working on currently. I know it's an interesting process writing these books, researching, and your next book is going to be on none other than the great Jay Siegel.
So I've gotten to know Jay over the years, and just like Heineman and Oliver, I always had a bit of a personal connection to him. I had played him one time in a golf match. He only beat me 8 and 7. I was straight off of a public course, and Jay was fresh back from the Masters. That gives you an idea of it wasn't a very fair fight, but he still was motivated enough to shoot 67 on a Ronimick, which. Up to that point was the best round of golf I had ever seen.
Incredible.
So anyway, and I've been connected with Jay a little bit over the years and got involved in his golf tournament. He has raised geez, $5.5 million for cancer for the Penn Abramson Cancer Center through his golf tournament over the last 30 years in Philadelphia. And every year he brings in great golf personalities. This year he had Peter Jacobson. So anyway, I came a little bit closer to Jay through that. And then also he is covered extensively in the Heineman book because they overlapped. In fact, in 1975, when Bill was actually 58 years old, he appeared as the number four, 1974, amateur in the country. Jay Siegel had never been in the top 10 amateurs in the country, but the next year he's rated 8 in the country and Heineman goes off the list. He goes into senior golf and goes onto the senior list. But anyway, they crossed paths so many times that Jay's name was in the book like 68 times. So I contacted him. I said, "Do you want to read this draft?" He was hemming and hawing, and I said, "Your name's in the book 68 times." He said, "Send me that draft." So anyway, Jay really liked the book, and we ended up developing a conversation around, his life, his career, and he said, "I'd like you to work with me on my book." He is doing this is a little different. This is just like the Kevin Riley book. It's going to be a memoir, so it's going to be in his voice, which I'm excited about, and I'm just helping him along the way. To get to that final product.
And
So
how old
that's what
is
we're
Jay
doing.
now?
Jay just turned 81 just last
Wow.
week.
Well, we are talking to John Reilly, author of several books, the latest two, How He Played the Game, Ed Porky Oliver, and Golf's Greatest Generation. And in addition to his latest book, A Will to Win, legendary amateur Bill Hindman's story of perseverance and triumph. And when we come back with John Reilly, we're going to talk about, I'd like to ask John your opinion on the amateur game overall and some issues going on in golf. So will you stick with us for a little bit?
Sure. Yep.
Okay, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and my guest is John Reilly. He authored How He Played the Game, Ed Porky Oliver, and Golf's Greatest Generation, in addition to his latest book, A Will to Win, legendary amateur Bill Hindman's story of perseverance and triumph. And John, I'm having so much fun talking to you. I want to ask you some questions about amateur golf and the professional game. Obviously, the great era of amateur golf seems to be over as we know it. And as you wrote about it, there is just so much money in the game. And, you know, players want to turn pro to cash in. What are your thoughts about all that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was just inevitable. And it was progressing along through Hyman's career. If, you know, you go back to his early days, it's interesting, you know, we talked about Oliver, and Oliver and Hyman knew each other. They played in some events together in the late 50s. They played in an Open together. They played in the Masters together. So they knew each other and were a bit connected. But the game was really changing throughout that period of time because more and more money started to come into the game, particularly in the early 60s with television and with Arnold Palmer. And it just started really ramping up. And more of the amateurs, as you went through the 60s and then into the 70s, we started to lose what, you know, I call in the book, I think, you know, can be mostly referred to as the, quote, career amateur. And there were a number of great career amateurs. You know, we'd go all the way back to Bobby Jones, and some call that, you know, the golden age of golf or the golden age of amateur golf. It was really sort of a second golden age of amateur golf in the 50s and in the 60s, on into the 70s to some extent. You know, you had those great amateurs who competed head to head in many situations against the pros. You know, the people like Hyman, like Billy Joe Patton, like Bill Campbell and Charlie Coe. So you can look at the, you know, top finishes in U.S. Opens and in Masters. The first U.S. Open that Hyman played in, he played the last two rounds with Sam Snead and beat Snead over 36 holes. I mean, that's how competitive, you know, the amateurs were. That's how competitive he was, and ended up finishing in the top 20 in that particular U.S. Open at Inverness. This progressed over time. You had more writers, you know, look, people like Ron Green down at, you know, in North Carolina and others, who started talking about the fact that there was more and more money in the game. Nothing like today, but just enough that it started appealing to these college age players. And soon, you know, by time you get to the Crenshaws, the Kites, and these other great amateurs, Watkins, they weren't sticking around in the amateur ranks very long. They were moving over to the professional game. So the very top of the talent was starting to go away, and they were going away, you know, much, much sooner. So, you know, by the 80s, you know, the great traditional amateur was almost gone. The great amateur at that time was Jay Sigel. He was still going strong. I mean, he was 38, I guess it was 38, when he won his first U.S. amateur. He won it again the next year. I mean, he's once again, like Hyman, he's beating all the kids. He's playing guys are almost like half his age. So he's as good as anybody in the game. Then he wins the second year, he won the Mid-Am at the same time. I mean, that was the first time, I believe, since Bobby Jones that anybody had won two national championships in the same year. He continued on doing that. He had already won one British amateur. Now, certainly there are more amateurs, but there's no one so dominant that could compete so often against the pros. And he played in, I believe, 11 Masters, as well as something like 9 US Opens, having to qualify for all of them, just like Hyman did. But,
Well, there was a time, John, where amateurs were more glorified than pros, right? Wasn't there a
Oh,
time?
that's exactly right. Hyman lost the U.S. Amateur to Harvey Ward. Harvey Ward won the U.S. Amateur again the next year. The next guy that would repeat as a U.S. Amateur champion, by the way, is Jay Sigel. If you go back to that point in time when Harvey Ward won his second amateur championship, I mean, crowds greeted him in San Francisco. I mean, the press were they were at the airplanes. You know, they were everywhere. Just like Bobby Jones getting a ticker tape parade. I mean, we were not getting ticker tape parades in the amateur game at that time, but it was still somewhat comparable to the pro game in terms of the publicity that they received. So the US Amateur was a really big deal. The other great amateur tournaments, for instance, like the North and South at Pinehurst every year, you know, enormous coverage, national coverage, but obviously, in time, that's going to fade, and it's all a result of the money in the game. So, you know, these kids that go to college, play at the top of the game, and they're going right off to the golf tour or trying to get on the golf tour. Some of them come back, play some of the amateur game, but not on a scale anything like it used to be.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, many people think that money and greed is really ruining men's professional golf, and particularly with the increased dollars being awarded to the top players, PGA tours limiting the field of play, creating signature events, prize money going to 20 million per tournament, and they're asking the sponsors to be responsible for that increase. And certainly all these players who jumped over to LIV for the big money. What are your thoughts about that? It just seems like money is really kind of ruining the golf that you and I kind of knew.
Yeah, it's a shame. I look, there were two great golf pros from Delaware. In addition to Porky, there was Davy Douglas. And Porky and Davy Douglas both won the Houston Open and the Texas Open. And what happens to those great tournaments? I mean, they have phenomenal histories, you know, that go back 75 years, tremendously meaningful to the history of the game. It's really a shame, and it's, you know, and of course they're also talking about reducing the size of the fields, particularly for these signature events, and you know, that's controversial as well. So I think it's, you know, I think it's unfortunate. I recognize that, you know, they're trying, you know, the tour is trying to compete with this crazy money that's coming out of, you know, out of LIV Golf and Saudi Arabia. So it's certainly a tough competitor in that sense. But I personally think it's unfortunate. I don't know if that might be an opening in my own mind. You know, I was reading your book, reading about the great LPGA players.
Life on the Green, Lessons in Wisdom from Legends of Golf.
There you go. And
Had the plug in.
you know, I think about that. I had an opportunity this past year to play with both Lexi Thompson and Lauren Coughlin in an event that Betsy King produced. You know, to me, it looks like maybe it's an opportunity for the women's game, and maybe it's an opportunity for amateur golf again. But I don't know how exactly how that plays out.
Right. Interesting point. Right. I know the women, they're talking a lot about, you know, how is the LPGA doing with this boom in women's sports now? I had the opportunity to walk 9 holes with Caitlin Clark in Annika's tournament. She was playing in the Pro-Am, and the crowds, the galleries that came out to see Caitlin Clark were phenomenal. And it was just such a great crossover to give the LPGA an audience beyond what they're used to, beyond the golfers. I mean, these are basketball fans who came to watch Caitlin, try to play some golf. And the criticism is with the LPGA, are they have they benefited from this boom in women's sports? Well, they don't get enough network TV coverage, John, which is key. I mean, I know the tournament, the last tournament of the season is this week. They're only on live, in a s narrow window on the weekend. And so you don't really get a chance to see them that much on network television. So who knows what's going to happen? They really have to start negotiating better deals with these networks just to get more prime time visibility. I like your point that maybe with fans being turned off by all the money in the professional men's game, maybe they'll focus more on the LPGA. And those women are great. And there's so much depth and talent with the women and with the amateur game as well.
Well, I had, back to the money. I was chair of the hospitality and fundraising for the BMW when it came here to Wilmington Country Club, and it was not easy raising the kind of money that they wanted to raise at that tournament. I mean, I probably talked to almost every business within, 25 miles of Wilmington Country Club, and we had a lot of success, and we basically sold it out. But you could really feel, I think you could begin to feel the pushback, from the potential sponsors about the money that they're being asked for to support this kind of, these kind of purses. This is, let's face it, and Caitlin Clark's the great example, right? I mean, I guess it was maybe the semifinal game of the NCAA ladies. I think it had double the audience of the Masters. I mean, just absolutely unbelievable, what she had done for college basketball and could do for women's golf. She could, who knows, maybe she could become the next Babe Zarias,
Yeah, she is taking lessons from an LPGA pro, which is great. And she had a pretty good swing. I mean, you got to give her credit just for going out there because she, is not playing much golf these days. But I did hit her. I did see her hit some very, very good shots. In fact, I recorded some of those great shots that she hit. But it was just so refreshing to see her and the people and fans that came out to watch her and to support women's golf. But another story that's come up is the fact that American players on the Ryder Cup team are going to be paid to play by the PGA. And that goes against everything I believe in as far as sports goes. I wasn't happy when Olympic athletes let in professional players. I always thought I've covered a number of Olympics for the radio rights holders, and I always thought that they should stick with amateur athletes. And now paying these Ryder Cup players to play on the on a international, one of the greatest international sporting events there is. And Rory McIlroy said, I would pay them to play on that team. I just don't think that sits well with a lot of people. That's kind of like the last straw to pay these Americans to play the Ryder Cup. What are your thoughts on that?
I kind of feel two ways. I'm like you. It's disappointing. I prefer it wasn't the way that it is. But when you compare it to other sports, it's not that different, is it? I mean, the NFL players are going to all get huge paychecks for playing in the Super Bowl, for playing in the playoffs. Everybody that played in the playoffs and in the World Series in baseball, just like the NBA, they're all going to get huge paychecks for doing all that. I guess in a way, it's just becoming like other sports, just like putting these players on contract and, paying them enormous amounts of money. The money in sports has gotten so crazy that I guess in a way, to me, it sort of offsets it. But I have found myself, so like when the Curtis Cup came to Marion 2 years ago, I mean, I couldn't wait to go up and watch that tournament and other top amateur tournaments and like the LPGA event that I played in, because I mean, to me, it's the way golf was meant to be played, frankly. I mean, you look at this, I dislike more the elements of the new game where it's drive it 350 yards and hit a wedge on the green. Don't even care where it goes. You know, you only have to learn three clubs, the
The birdie
driver,
fest.
the wedge, and the putter. And if you can dominate those three clubs, I mean, you look at Ben Hogan in the 1952, 51 US Open, the famous at Oakland Hills, brought the monster to its knees. I mean, I went through that analysis in the Oliver book. I mean, he's hitting all these greens. He's hitting everything up to one iron. I think he hit 4 1-irons onto the greens, another 2-iron. The outside of the par fives, the shortest club he hit into a par four was a 7-iron. So I mean, the skill level to hit those shots time and time again that Ben Hogan had and those pros compared to these guys today, like DeChambeau. Well, I'll just hit it 400 yards and I'll hit a wedge on the green. I think it's just unfortunate for golf. That bothers me as much as the money does.
Oh, it does. Oh, wow. Yeah, well, all these issues. But you think about the sport, and golf was the only sport, and still is, where you call your own penalty. The integrity of a golfer has to be the utmost, right? Golf was the only sport where if you didn't make the cut, you didn't get paid. And they're getting rid of that in many of these signature events. And now they're talking about paying the Americans who make the Ryder Cup team. It just doesn't seem to be going in the kind of direction that fans appreciate. So yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we can just appreciate amateur golf and the LPGA a little bit more, and certainly enjoy the history that you write in your two books, John Reilly, How He Played the Game, Ed Porky Oliver, and Golf's Greatest Generation, and A Will to Win, Legendary Amateur Bill Hindman's Story of Perseverance and Triumph. It's been a pleasure talking to you about these books and your writing career and the research done on these terrific players. Continued success, and thanks for spending time with me on Sports Interview.
Well, thank you, Anne. It's been great to be with you. And these folks that I write about, they deserve to be remembered. They had a big impact. They had a big impact on the game, and they had a big impact on the people around them and life. I mean, when we had that kickoff event for the book in Huntington Valley, the turnout was amazing. The enthusiasm. There's a lot out there for these folks who really were pioneers in a lot of ways.
I can't wait to read the book on Jay Siegel. Continued success, John. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Anne.
Be sure to order John Reilly's books on Amazon. Print, ebook, and audio versions of John Reilly's books are available on Amazon or at www.awilltowin.com. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. My thanks to John Reilly and to Mike Goodsell in production. As the great Winston Churchill once said, and as both Bill Hindman and Porky Oliver displayed throughout their lives, success is not final, failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts. Have a great week, and I look forward to visiting with you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.